Bună ziua și bine ați venit la un nou sezon din Atac Târziu, din podcast, sezonul 3, episodul 1, și avem un invitat foarte special pentru voi. E vorba despre un inginer de cursă foarte titrat, care a avut primul job la M-Sport, primul job din carieră la așa nivel, da? Ei bine, se poate, și o să ne explice și cum s-a putut asta. După care a fost inginer la Jaguar în Formula 1, după care în DTM, GP2, Formula 2, Formula 3 și așa mai departe, și anul ăsta lucrăm împreună. În primul rând trebuie să-l prezint însă pe Vali. Salut, Vali!
Salut, ce listă lungă e acolo pentru domnul James. Nu mai terminai odată.
Păi are CV-ul, nu mi-au încăput, n-am rămas fără pagini la imprimantă.
The longest CV ever.
Yes, James Goodfield. Hello, James.
Hello, James.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Vali. How are you?
What did you understand?
I understood everything perfectly. Horia, you forgot to mention A1GP in your introduction.
I did say I ran out of paper in my printer for your CV, James.
Okay. Well, look, before we go any further, I have to apologize. We will have to continue in English because my Romanian is a little bit rusty.
Oh, fuck. No problem. I'll do the translation.
James, how is it possible that someone on this planet gets the first job as an engineer at M-Sport?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? I would like to say luck, and for sure luck plays a major part, but I think to a certain extent you make your own luck in life and particularly in motorsport. So I worked very, very hard. I applied for jobs with every motorsport company that existed. The guys at M-Sport were generous enough to offer me an interview. And ultimately, yeah, to give me a job. A lot of it was luck, you know. It was the year that M-Sport won the Ford contract to run the works boards in WRC. So they were a relatively small team that needed to increase their workforce quite quickly. And I guess a graduate engineer was a relatively cheap way of doing that. But it still showed a lot of foresight by Malcolm and John Steele, who ran the company, to take me on, I guess.
Well, you say luck. I think it's mostly skill, because I'm sure they had many people in the interviews, but you got the job, so...
I think, to be honest, I don't know if that's the case, but I know that I wrote so many letters to those guys, they probably in the end thought, the best way we're going to stop this guy writing to us is to give him a job.
But that was quite an exciting time to be in rallies, wasn't it? It was that time where drivers were drivers... You could do whatever you, well, not whatever you wanted on the cars, but a lot of stuff on the cars, right?
I mean, in terms of it being a great era, I suppose different people will have different views on what great eras were. For me, it was the most amazing time. And we'll start with an interesting story. So I was at university in Cardiff from 94 to 97. And during that time, I wrote to M-Sport a few times asking for a job, either as an internship in the summer breaks or when I graduated. And in 97, when I was due to graduate in June, I got a letter from them saying, yeah, why not come up, meet the team, let's have a chat. So I think I even bought a suit specially, which, you know, ridiculous, isn't it? I went up to M-Sport. M-Sport's based quite remotely in the north of England. I traveled up on the train. I don't remember how I got to the factory. I think maybe they collected me from the train station or something. But I went to the factory. I met Mark Amblard, who was then the technical director. You know, and bearing in mind at this stage, I'm a sort of 19-year-old, still sort of very much a rally fan as much as somebody wanting to work in it. I had a chat with Mark Amblard. Mark then says, why not meet Malcolm? Crikey, this is actually Malcolm Wilson, you know, the British rally champion. Wow. And, you know, all the rest of it. So I go into his office and he basically looked at me and said, why do you want to work at M-Sport? I don't remember what I said. And then he said, what are you going to bring to M-Sport if I employ you? And that was when I really thought, actually, this could happen. I obviously said something fairly impressive, but I don't remember what it was.
Something clever.
Maybe unlikely, Harry, you know me. Nevertheless, I go back to Mark, having met Malcolm. And Mark says, we've got a test going on in the forest. I think it was Winlatter Forest, just down the road. Do you want to come and see what we do at a test? I was like, geez, this is unbelievable. You know, this is proper rally fan in me now coming out. So we go off to this test, and I honestly kind of thought that was my day made. It was only when we got there that they had Juha Kankkonen testing the car. And like, for me, this is rally hero, you know? So yeah, my interview, before my first job, before I'd even graduated from university, I'd been to M-Sport, I'd met the technical director, I'd met the boss, and then I'd gone to a test where they had Juha Kankkonen testing.
Wow, that must have been blew your socks off.
Absolutely, completely. You know, pretty unbelievable, really, when you think about it, isn't it?
How did you get to the forest? Did they drive you there?
No, I don't remember. It's a long time ago.
No, I was expecting you to say they flew you in a helicopter as well.
No, that happened later, only after I'd been employed.
It did?
I flew in the helicopter quite a lot, yeah.
Okay, so that's how you do it, Vali. You have to fly in helicopters to the rally stages.
It's not so complicated. I can do it.
No, it would also mean you could get back to the podcast in time, Vali.
It's not like you were half an hour late again, but it's a fine. It's okay.
No, it's difficult with the van and with the trailer. You cannot do it so quick.
Yeah, it's tricky to tow a trailer with a helicopter.
Okay, so after that, you obviously got the job. Who did you work with at the beginning? Were you assigned to a certain car, or was it like a joint group of engineers for all the cars?
Things were very, very different back then. At that point, M Sport had Mark Amblard as chief engineer or technical director, and it had two other engineers, one of whom was sort of relatively recently promoted from the workshop. One was a guy who'd been rallying for a few years, had a lot more experience in tin top circuit racing, and then me. And we used to sort of, I mean, those guys between them shared the rallies as sort of lead engineer. We didn't have the traditional kind of one race engineer and one data engineer per car like we have in circuit racing nowadays. We just have a kind of senior engineer running the two cars on the events with maybe some assistance. And that was kind of, for me, the first part of my story was to go and assist and to learn the trade and to understand things a bit, because quite frankly, I knew nothing at the beginning.
So this is another question. Sorry to interrupt. In university, generally speaking, they teach you, I presume you did some motorsport type of university, right?
No, absolutely not. And I'm glad I didn't. I would never have chosen to go that route. I did a, dare I say, proper mechanical engineering degree with no,
okay, that's great.
No specialisms at all.
So I'm asking you this because there's no specialized university for racing in Romania. So there's mechanical engineering, obviously, but then the people feel like, oh, I couldn't possibly apply for a job in racing because I haven't done any racing degree. I've only got mechanical engineering, but you're saying that's actually better for you.
Well, back then we didn't have motorsport engineering degrees like we have now. For me personally, I've been in a position since then to employ engineers. My personal experience is that the guys who've done traditional engineering degrees and then specialized either through experience or going on and getting extra training tend to have a broader depth of understanding than the guys who've done a purely motorsport degree. Maybe I'm a little bit biased because one of the things I do through the winter is I actually teach at a motorsport training school. So for anybody interested, mtschool.it. It's an Italian school. And we teach graduate engineers how to go on and apply their knowledge to motorsport. So it's slightly different.
This is the one you invited me to.
You're more than welcome to come anytime.
So after you joined M Sport and you got to learn about racing and stuff like that, did you switch to Formula One with Jaguar, which was quite an impressive move. I mean, from WRC to F1 and then to DTM, that's quite a CV, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think at the time I probably appreciated quite how lucky I was to have those steps. I think probably before we're moving forwards quite quickly. I mean, I spent 5 years at M Sport and five fantastic years, you know, working with some amazing people on some amazing projects. You know, those first couple of years we were running the Escort WRC. So I joined in August 97. February 98, I found myself in Safari with M Sport. Mm-hmm. I've already mentioned Juha Kankkonen. We went to Safari that year with Juha Kankkonen. I think in the other car was Bruno Thierry. In fact, it was Bruno Thierry. And Bruno injured himself on the recce. That year we took five WRC cars for two drivers. So we had two recce cars, one test car, two recce cars and two rally cars, all full WRC cars for one event.
Huh. You did the recce with the WRC cars as well?
Yes, because the terrain out there is so extreme. Indeed. It was the only option, really. I think the following year, subsequent years, I think M Sport built some special Land Rovers, some sort of kind of Group N spec Land Rovers to use when it was not allowed to use the WRC cars anymore. And then I suspect later on it went to Group N cars like most recces are. But back then, yeah, it was proper. It was a lot of kit, a lot of people, a lot of money, obviously. But unfortunately, on that event, Bruno injured himself on the recce. So we had to replace him. And I mean, as if having Kankkonen there wasn't great enough, Malcolm got Ari Vatanen to drive the second car. So my first WRC event was Safari Rally 98 with Vatanen and Kankkonen.
Wow.
And we finished second and third.
That's amazing.
That's a pretty good start, isn't it?
Yeah, but then it went even better, I think. I mean, you had Colin, didn't you?
Yeah, so as well as, you know, the Flying Finns, the kind of heroes of my childhood, obviously, as time went by, we moved on. We had Colin McRae for a few years, and obviously we had Carlos Sainz as well. So yeah, big names, huge names.
I know you're not one to name drop, but how was it like working with Colin McRae and Carlos Sainz.
It's like working with any champion or anybody at the top of their game. These are guys who are incredibly talented for one, obviously, but incredibly hardworking, because talent alone is never enough, is it? You've got to work hard and you've got to be committed and you've got to be fairly strong in the way that you go about things. So it's incredibly rewarding working with these guys, but it's also quite tough because obviously they expect the same level of dedication that they're prepared to put in. So, you know, they guys like that push the whole thing forward. They push everybody forward. They make everybody, you know, think very hard about every decision and, yeah, push things pretty hard. So it's incredibly rewarding working with guys like that. It's also incredibly tough at times, but yeah, overriding feeling is you'd never pass up the opportunity to work with somebody who's that talented and that good at what they do.
I actually met Nicky Grist at one point and I asked him about working with Colin, and he said to me, he said, we weren't there to be friends or mates, we were there to do a job. And I think that's in a nutshell what he meant as well.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, and we're not just talking about Colin here. I would imagine in any sport, you look at any professional person and their whole life is around being successful at their sport. And when you put that much effort in, that much dedication, you can't afford to have people around you who aren't doing the same and who aren't prepared to sacrifice as much to help achieve the objectives. People will explain it in different ways, but it's just a different level when you work with people who are that good and that committed to, in order to allow them to become multiple world champions.
Okay, so answer me this. What happened if, for example, one of the two drivers wanted the car in a certain direction and the other one wanted it in a different direction? Would you do that, or would you just stick to one of the two options?
That's probably not too different to how things tend to be now. You'd always try on a particular event to have cars going in the same direction, because you don't want major differences between them for a whole host of reasons, spare parts or being able to compare one against the other. But at the same point, if you've got two top guys, you know, if you've got a Colin and a Carlos and one wants one and one wants something different, you can't in the end say no. You can explain the situation and try to rationalize why one way might be better than the other. But at the end of the day, if they want something a bit different because it suits their style more, then that's what you're going to do, isn't it?
So it's still a question of style. I mean, I don't know how it is now, obviously, because I look at the rally cars now compared to the rally cars back then, and they just seem to be on rails.
On rails.
Not I really. Think it's fair to say that the current breed of WRC car has got to be one of the best cars to watch of all time, hasn't it? I mean, it's kind of Group B levels of performance with hopefully, you know, greater safety. But the spectacle is just incredible. I actually really love the current breed of WRC cars.
Valley, you obviously haven't driven a WRC car, but you've driven an R5, an R5 car, which is basically the national level mini WRC.
Yes.
From your perspective, how much tuning and how much changing the car is there at this level? At the national level,
it is a different car completely. I was used to drive Mitsubishi till the first R5, and for me that level was the best. I imagine that WRC and R5, it is amazing, but I didn't drive it yet. And when I drove the first time the R5, I was completely wow. I said, it's not possible to drive on roads like this, for example, on gravel, and the car to behave like this, to brake like this, to steer like this. This was the most amazing part about steering.
Steering, not the braking. Same time, the steering was more...
Yes, the braking after that. All the time, where you put steering, the car drives exactly, perfectly. In the Mitsubishi, it has a little lag. You turn now, and the car turns 10 meters later. And the braking, because the weight distribution is different, all the stuff about suspension, it's better, and it's a very fun car to drive. And now turning back into Mitsubishi, it's horror. I'm not used to drive it anymore, and I think I have two left hands, like we say in Romania, two left side hands.
I tell you, I was quite lucky, obviously, at that stage to ride in the cars quite often, either when we were testing or whatever. And the one thing that always surprised me about the WRC car was, yeah, the power's good, the grip's good, the steering's good. But what always amazed me was the dampers are so good in kind of longitudinal forwards and backwards. But you'd kind of think when you were sliding at 45 or 60 degrees to the road, if you went through a big ditch, the car would want to roll over. But the way the car would go sideways over the roughest of terrain just always blew my mind completely. That was the one thing that always stuck in my mind.
So it doesn't matter how rough the road was or how deep the ditch, if you were sideways, it still stayed on the road. It wouldn't flip.
Yes.
There must be a limit, I guess, but it always surprised me where that limit was.
Yeah, physics, yeah.
First time, for example, when I drove the Skoda on a circuit in Romania, the first kilometers on tarmac.
On a what, sorry? On a circuit in Romania?
Yes, in motor park.
Wow. Oh, okay. You've never been there, actually.
In some corner, it starts to slide a little bit too much. It was 90 degrees on the road. And I said in my mind, oh, fuck, now it's a little bit too much and I will for sure spin it. And I said, okay, let's try it. I countersteer maximum, put from fourth gear to third gear, maximum gas, and the car went straight on. I said, no, it's impossible. It can't be. It can't be real.
It is incredible how good the grip of these cars is. It really is, yeah. I guess the R5 is actually just like a mini WRC now, isn't it, in terms of behavior?
The thing is, after the whole romantic era of, I think you were lucky also, James, because of your age, really, because you got to get involved with rallies exactly after university, where you were still, as you said, a fan. And I see this in you whenever we talk face to face, that you've got this passion about racing still very much alive, which people can obviously forget over the years, but you don't. And I've always appreciated the fact that, I'm not saying you're a fan, first of all, but you've never lost the spark.
I think you're right that it's very easy when it becomes a job to lose the passion and to lose the thing that got you there in the first place. The one thing that I really like about it, and I like about the fact it's my job, is it's still a sport and there's still a challenge, there's still a competition. And I think that really excites me. I think if you said do exactly the same job, but at the end of the day, the result doesn't matter, I wouldn't have the passion. But it's about that challenge, you know, and whether you're fighting to help somebody get their first points or to win a race, it's the same. The challenge is still the same. It's the challenge to do the best job you possibly can. I think that's what really drives me.
I saw this also because, well, we have to say, we had a tough year together. We didn't score any points. It was the first time in my career when I had a year without points. And I think, I imagine for you, it was similar. Still, never gave up, always on top of everything. I was really impressed, honestly. And I think looking back at what you mentioned from your CV and so on, going to these big teams like M Sport, Jaguar F1, and DTM with Mercedes, right?
I actually did the first 2 years with Opel.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Anyway, so big teams, then you switch to single seaters, and now we're talking smaller teams, right? I mean, once you go to GP2 or Formula 2 and Formula 3, it's a community of, I don't know how many, 12, 15 people rather than 1,000 people. So you like it more in such a small world, well, I mean, where you can
first thing
make
to mention,
a big difference?
First thing to mention is when I joined M Sport, it was tiny. You know, it's a really small family business. So it wasn't, certainly wasn't thousands of people. It probably wasn't even hundreds at that stage. But obviously, as things progressed, it got bigger. And you're right that going back to, so from DTM was still fairly big. And my next job from there was A1GP, which was a team of about 12 of us who traveled around the world. And then GP2, which became Formula 2 and now Formula 3. We're this year 11 people to run the three F3 cars in Carlin. I think there's pros and cons about both. It's nice to be in a small team where you know everybody really well and you have really strong relationships. But the downside is obviously you're just running a spec car that's provided with still fairly wide but limited setup options. Whereas in the big works teams, basically you're homologating your own car. So you have the freedom to design, to develop, and to improve the car in whichever direction the driver steers you effectively. So there's definitely pros and cons from both.
Yeah, so you could basically develop even in WRC and then obviously Formula 1 and DTM. If you had a crazy idea, I don't know, let's try the diff in this way or whatever, you would be allowed to do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think even more fundamentally, when I was at M Sport, the Escort when I started was a sequential box. In fact, they'd just moved to the sequential box from the old H pattern, but it wasn't hydraulic shift. It wasn't paddle shift. So when we did the Focus, the first Focus cars were also manual shift, but we introduced the first hydraulic gear shift with the paddle shift on that car. We did things like the active diffs, traction control, all sorts of things that were, you know, pretty, all completely within the regulations, obviously, but still sort of pushing the boundaries. And in terms of engineering, really exciting. Yeah, really, really exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. And 25 years later, Valli has an active diff and he doesn't know who invented it. There you go.
I'm not taking claim for that. We had active diffs when I started, but we introduced them to all the axles, which wasn't originally the case. So, yeah.
In R5s, no more active diffs.
So Horia, Valley doesn't even have an active diff.
No, I have it doesn't even have an R5.
On Mitsubishi.
I did ask James this before we got recording, because obviously Valley was late. So I'm going to ask him now again. I'm going to put you on the spot a bit, James. Rally drivers or circuit drivers? Who do you think is the better of the two? It's an ongoing conversation. Everybody has an opinion. You've worked with both. So tell us.
Okay, so I just have to try and remember what you said, Horia. You said that if I said the rally drivers were best, that would make Valley happy and you'd pay me £100. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool. No, it's a very good question. And seriously, as you said, we've discussed this already. I think, as I said to you before, a fairly big difference between the two. And that is that certainly what I liked back then about the rally drivers was they'd go into a stage that maybe they'd recce'd a week earlier, with not necessarily any knowledge of the current conditions, be it snow or ice, or be it the gravel conditions, and they'd have to drive as close to the limit as they possibly could, which is pretty close. The circuit drivers tend to have practice sessions, maybe at least 45 minutes, before they have to go and set their ultimate qualifying lap. So they're actually practicing. So what they're trying to do is see how close to 100% they can get, whereas the rally drivers are seeing what's the quickest I can go without any practice, which I think is a kind of different skill. And I think, well, let's be fair, in both cases, you've got to be really good to be the best. But I think the rallying requires a certain level of natural ability, natural skill level, that racing drivers can teach themselves because they have a chance to do a number of laps, look at their data, and understand how to improve their lap time. Whereas the rally drivers, if you get it wrong on that one hit, you're probably in the trees or, you know, certainly lost a load of time. So they're different skills, but my opinion is the rally drivers probably have a little bit more natural ability in most cases.
There you go, Vali. Are you happy?
Of course.
Well, you have to tell James the story about when you drove on a circuit as well in the Bucharest City Challenge.
Oh, no. With the Logan?
Yes.
Oh, it was a hell of a mess.
I hear something about shortcuts.
Some of them. Drive-through.
Tell us, Vali. Tell us.
You told him about drive-through, Horia?
No, you're famous. No, you have to tell him.
It was a small cut in some part of a chicane. One time, two times.
When you say a small cut, Vali, a small cut is something we have in rallying. It doesn't exist in racing, right?
It wasn't so much, half a meter.
Track limits.
Not with the whole car, only half a meter. And then on the straight line, I saw a big guy there with the
big guy
with helmet and glasses showing me drive through. I saw him thumbs up. Okay, I will do it. Second pass, the same drive through. Okay, boss, I'm doing it. Third time for that.
So you hold on. Let me get this clear. You drove through the chicane?
Yes, I didn't cut it anymore.
You stopped cutting it. You just drove through.
Oh, yeah. You're my hero.
And I didn't understand why it's still showing me this, because I understood from the first time.
So tell what happened in the end.
The race stopped because it was a black flag, because some other driver hit something, and she was very tall, and she got the knee touched. Ooh, wow. Under the wheel.
They didn't black flag you? They didn't stop you? Just you?
No. The whole race.
Okay, so they red flagged the race.
Red flag, sorry. No.
Yes.
I thought about the black flag, because if this crash didn't happen, I got the black flag for sure. And maybe I was doing the same thumbs up, okay?
This is a fantastic
literally
story,
saved by the black flag. So,
saved by the bell, yes.
Was this the end of your circuit racing career?
Yes, it was the first and the last time.
We need to see more of this.
Oh, there's also some footage somewhere on the internet with him on two wheels hitting a wall.
You can search on YouTube, Valino at BCC.
Well,
Valino,
I think BCC. It's better if you write it here, Vali, and he'll be able to Google it afterwards.
Everybody listening to the podcast is going to be looking for this now, Vali.
For sure, but they saw it.
The problem is it was only a national mess so far, but now it's going to be international because James will share it with Malcolm Wilson.
Can we cut this?
You're gonna be huge all over England now.
not good at all.
All in all, I think it's all good and fun, but rally drivers are rally drivers and single-seater drivers are single-seater drivers. And to me, what we were talking about before, James, was about how they have to be 100% without really knowing the stage they're on, or the part of the stage they're on. But Vali was telling me sometimes they go into this rhythm, which is not 100%, right, Vali? So you're not pushing all the time.
Not 100%. All the time, yes. No, 90%. But when you need to push, you can push. But sometimes you need to take it 60%, 70%. It depends on the...
I have to say, my experience of that would be, if you're, if you've had a pretty good day and you've been on clean roads and you're leading the rally by, 5 minutes or something, of course you have to know when to back off and just sort of cruise a little bit. But generally speaking, I think when you're fighting, I would expect the guys to be pushing 100% the whole time. And certainly when you look at the WRC guys and you see when they make a mistake, it's not a small mistake. It's usually a big accident
or small mistakes.
Exactly. And I think that shows these guys are pushing pretty much to the limit all the time.
Yeah, definitely. It's also different budgets as well, James.
Of course.
It's very true. Yeah. They don't have to put the car back together when it goes wrong, do they?
No. And I remember I watched something on a documentary on Colin, actually. And there was a time where he was with Subaru and his car was mostly taped up because he had shunted it so bad they could not fix it properly. So it was just taped up from one end to the other. And you're thinking, wow, that would never happen nowadays or on our types of racing, on circuit racing.
No more.
No, circuit racing, having said that, we're recording this on the Monday after Le Mans race. And I think that's probably one of the few races where, getting to the end is the big objective. So we do tend to see a few cars with, let's say, non-original repairs. But generally speaking, in circuit racing, the cars are either perfect or it's not on the track, because the performance loss from having a car that's not correct is just too great. So there's never any benefit from being on track unless the car is working correctly. Whereas I think in rally, if you can get the car through a stage and get it back to service, the guys are pretty incredible and they can normally then repair the car. So, certainly when I was doing it, we had occasions when cars would come back to service with three wheels on, and the guys would work their magic and the car would leave the service like it's leaving a showroom. So yeah, a little bit different to circuit racing for sure.
Are they also different people, the mechanics? Are they just, maybe cockier or the rally mechanics?
I feel like you're leading me down a path here where you want me to say something that's going to upset every mechanic.
No, I'm not. I'm not. No, I just...
they're all very, very skilled guys who know their job and who know their car. And obviously, with every level, you've got your kind of experienced number one mechanics and your least experienced mechanics and the least experienced are learning all the time. So there's a huge range in every team, whether it's circuit racing or rallying, but the skilled guys are equally skilled. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be able to switch just like the drivers wouldn't, but the skills are definitely...
No, that's what I mean. There's a different skill set necessary for Formula cars and for rally cars, obviously.
Yeah.
But also, I think from what I've seen in single-seaters so far, yes, there is a food chain. I mean, the technical guy and the engineers and chief engineers and so on, they are higher up the food chain, but they're all at the same level. They're still teammates. The mechanics have a say when it comes to the order of the operations and the prep and so on. It's not like you're an engineer, so you treat the mechanic as being beneath you,
Oh, no, I mean, absolutely not. I think we've got to be careful there because it's going to be team specific as well. There'll be some teams where it's very much engineering led. The engineers make the decisions, the mechanics do what they're told. And there'll be other teams where the mechanics have a much bigger say and the engineers, are there to work with the drivers. It's not necessarily rallying is one way, racing is another. It's quite team specific that. And there's no right way or wrong way. I've worked in teams in both kind of directions. And as long as everybody understands the way that decisions are made is absolutely fine. It just depends on the structure and the quality of people. If you've got a load of really good mechanics, then of course you want their information, you want their say on how things are done. And particularly in rally, if you've got a car coming into a 45-minute service that needs a new windscreen and a gearbox and a set of dampers, the mechanics have to be able to say to the engineers, sorry, we're not going to do your setup change because it's more important we do these things. And to a certain extent, the same thing works in circuit racing. The mechanics have to be able to say, if we've got an engine change, we can't also do, your damper change or whatever. So differences for sure. I mean, the one thing I would say, we've talked about the difference between the rally drivers and the circuit drivers. And we don't see much overlap. We don't see many circuit racers going rallying or rally drivers going circuit racing. We do see a bit more of the mechanics switching between the two roles. So it probably is a bit easier for them. than it is for the drivers.
Yeah, probably. How is it with you, Vali? How does it work in your team? If you want something changed to the car, are you telling them what to do, or are you more like the guy who listens and then the engineer tells you what you should be doing with the car?
What engineer?
Okay. So you have to explain this a little bit to James, how you can function without an engineer, him being an engineer.
No, you should explain him.
I wonder, if you don't have an engineer, who makes the tea, Vali?
No tea. We don't drink tea, only water.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's the first mistake.
Horia, you know me and you know my tea. That's a very strange situation, not drinking tea.
You know, that's my role. I make James's tea. So.
Ah, okay, good.
Vali, he makes very good tea as well.
So the first step is learn about tea. The second step is get an engineer.
Okay, good.
So basically, you as a driver then tell the mechanic, I need you to do this for me on the car. So you're also the engineer?
Sometimes, yes.
What about that, James?
It's not a surprise to me in the slightest, because that's another of the differences from my experience, was that the rally drivers themselves were also able to engineer the car at a much more detailed level than a lot of race drivers are. The race drivers are very good at telling you what they need from the car, and some of them have an understanding or some experience of changes that have given them what they want. The rally drivers, in my experience, certainly back then, seem to be able to say, no, I need to change this spring to this spring, or this roll bar, or whatever. And I think some of that came from the fact that a lot of the rally drivers, certainly back in the day when I was doing it, at 15 years old, they'd have an old, I don't know, Vauxhall Nova or Peugeot 205 or something that they would be driving around the lanes or on their father's farm or whatever, and they would be repairing it themselves. So they'd have a bit more hands-on experience. So it's not a big surprise to hear that Vali would say he understands what changes to make.
A good driver has to be a good mechanic also.
I think it's a fair point.
Yeah, James, but you've been working with Vatanen, Kankkunen, Sainz, McRae. So of course these guys would know about springs and, you know what I mean?
You never mentioned Petter Solberg, Horia, do you?
Oh, no.
My God, here we go. I know you don't like to name drop, but you just keep them in your pocket and boom.
Well, you know, another fantastic guy that I was lucky enough to work with, yeah.
No, but you actually mentioned Petter to me at one point. I think you forgot, once we had our tea and you said to me, Petter is a nice guy. He's a great guy.
Yeah, I ran Petter. He joined Ford as a works driver in probably 2000, I guess, because it was the first year we ran the Focus. So it would have been 99, actually. We'd been to Monte Carlo with the Focus, finished third, I think, but had a small problem with the position of the water pump, as I recall. But we won't talk about that.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
we then went to Sweden, and the other engineers were running the Focus cars, and I was running a couple of customer escort cars, and one of them was for Petter in his first rally as a works Ford driver. I think we finished 11th, maybe even a bit
better.
With
the escort?
With the escort, yeah.
Oh, cool.
I don't remember where they finished with the Focus. I think maybe they finished third again. But yeah, that was Petter's first run in as a works driver in a Ford, yeah. So a pretty big moment, that one.
Would you say, so you were basically engineering Petter at his debut, which is a big deal considering where he went afterwards.
Yeah.
So you set the foundations for his success.
that guy was destined to be a champion. It was a bit of a shame he didn't stay with Ford and do it with Ford, really, because he was quite clearly going to be a champion.
Was it a big fight? Rivalry between M-Sport and ProDrive?
In as much as it always is between teams, there was nothing special about the relationship. And on events, you know, everybody, you know, like we've had this year, Horia, where, you know, you have 10 teams in the paddock and you all want to beat each other, but there's no big animosity. You know, everybody will have a beer in the hotel when we don't have COVID, or, you know, we'll play live music in the paddock and everyone joins in. It's much the same back then in rally, but of course on the stages, we wanted to beat them more than anything.
Yeah, I think what I like about rallies is the fact that, Vali was also saying, sometimes someone has a problem, you'll help him out, Vali, right? You'll give him...
Of course, if you can do it.
If you have a spare turbo, you'll give it to him.
For sure.
Or something.
Everything. Is not normal to do it?
It's normal, but...
You know, I mentioned before that I like my job because it's still a sport. And that, for me, says everything. That is what a sport is. You want to beat the other guys...
On the stages.
Because you've beaten them. Not because their cars failed or because some bad luck. You just want to go and race them and beat them fairly. in exactly the same way that I have a big problem with cheating in sport, the opposite side is if you can help somebody, you'll help them. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to win just because the other guy couldn't compete. You want to win because you're better than him. Is that right, Vali?
Yes, yes, for sure.
But if he's crashing, no, of course. You're driving too fast for him anyway, so you'll beat that. I think that's fair. You've beaten him then. If he's just unlucky, that's different.
Yeah, I mean, you've pushed him so hard that he went over his limit.
Yeah.
So also, you've done something. to there's pressure, right? I mean, you feel the pressure as a rally driver. It's not just in single seaters. It's like wheel to wheel. You can see the guy who wants to overtake you. But for you in rallies, it's a different kind of pressure because you go by, I don't know if you have split times on the stages
nothing.
Or whatever.
When you are driving on the stage, you can imagine how fast that driver can go around these corners. Or,
which is even worse. Imagination for me is worse than numbers.
Yes.
You know?
It's worse, yes. Because all the time you think, no, I was too slow. He for sure was faster here. So when you are neck and neck, it's a little bit better to see the difference.
Yeah, I imagine engineering-wise as well, James. It's a different thing when you have the data and you can compare. Okay, he's been doing this, he's been doing that, whereas they have nothing.
I don't know that it's too different, really. I mean, in a works team in particular, you'd have multiple drivers, so you'd be able to compare data. Just the same as we do in Formula 3 or Formula 2, we can compare our drivers. So we can see if one's a little bit braking later or whatever. I think that would be the same. Obviously, when they're in the stage, you don't have any sort of live telemetry, but then we don't have that in Formula 3 either. So there's not a big difference there.
Yeah, well, I think what I mean is they don't use data at all, I think. Do you, Vali?
It is some data, but you cannot compare it to anything else.
Yeah, because you're the only one in your team with that car. So
also that, yes, but...
But I think if you went, let's say you had a day's testing on a tarmac road or something for a tarmac rally test, you could do the same stage, you know, 20 times with different setups, and you could compare the data, and you could not just use your feedback value, but also the data to understand a little bit if a different setup change was working or not.
Yes, but usually we are not doing testing.
That's another story.
Only small testing. Only to see if the car is going well and the wheels are straight. The steering wheel is pointed in the right direction and that's all. The braking is working. Okay, good. We can start.
Did he just blow your mind, James?
We need to get this guy testing.
I agree. I agree, especially because I know he's very fast. So he's very fast without ever having a proper testing plan, a proper data comparison. Even when he had a team with a big budget and whatever, they still weren't exploring all the options and looking into every... I mean, we're talking about basics here, where you brake, where... I'm not saying lateral load of the tires and stuff like that, which you look at and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I think, I understand, Vali, you have a rally school. We need to get a data logger on your rally car.
Yes, we can do it. On rally school, maybe it can help for the new drivers.
Okay, so I have to invite you to Romania, James, and... We can sit down and make a proper plan and a proper tea for Vali.
Oh,
and we
good.
Can make him tea, yeah.
Finally.
Well, James, it's been a pleasure. I don't want to keep you too long because obviously it's late in England as well, but also for Vali, it's like 11:30 or something now.
Yes.
So if you don't mind, I think we'll get this further in this part two of our conversation or part three or five or whatever. But for now, thank you very much for making the time and for being with us here.
It's been my absolute pleasure. I think it's my first time on a Romanian podcast and hopefully it won't be my last one.
I'm sure it won't. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. It was a pleasure to
nice,
talk
nice to
you.
Speak to you, Vali. Yeah,
thank you
too,
very
mate.
Much.
You take care. All righty.